Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I'm happy to be here. I'm your host, Ted Flanagan. And this week I'm joined by Steve Nadell, the Executive Director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, ACEEE. I've known Steve for a long time. It's great to have him on the show today. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
I'm really glad to have you on. And I've just introduced you as the Executive Director of ACEEE. And you have been there now for 34 years, is that right?
Yes.
You've got to be the longest standing employee of ACEEE.
I am. I was employee number 4, and the other 3 had since left.
That's great. Let's go all the way back. Born and raised where?
Outside of New York City, New York City suburbs.
Like where?
A place called White Plains.
White Plains. I mean, I grew up in New York too. So I was just back in Oyster Bay for a couple weeks. And when you were a little kid, what did you think you would be when you grew up? Were you going to be the president or a fireman or what? What were you going to be?
I went through lots of different things. I was interested in astronomy. So I think for a while I was going to be an astronomer.
An astronaut?
No, I was more the astronomer, looking at telescope type thing.
Yeah. And then what high school, what was what? Did you get into sports or was it music or what was it?
All sorts of things. Yes, I played soccer. Yes, I started doing some long distance hiking. I got involved in some urban environmental fairs. So by the time I went to college, I was looking for urban and environmental studies.
Right. And then off to Westland, right?
Correct.
Which is a lot of listeners in California. So that is outside of Hartford?
In between Hartford and New Haven.
In between Hartford and New Haven, right along the I-90.
What is just it? Off of I-91, which goes from New Haven up to Vermont and eventually Canada.
Right. And then at Wesleyan, undergraduate government and then
government. Yeah, and then I also did a lot of environmental and urban studies work. They didn't have a major, so I wound up getting my master's in environmental studies there.
And then it was after that that you went to New Haven and worked for this community-based organization, is that right?
Yes, exactly.
And what was the focus of that group?
So that group did housing renovation in inner-city neighborhoods. These were tended to be bombed-out buildings, that people would buy for a few $1,000s. Needed a total gut rehab. And we would work with the family who would buy the house for a few $1,000s, would take out the money to get financing. And we'd prepare the architectural plans, the architectural specs. We'd oversee the contractors, but it was their house from the get-go. And my end of things was designing an energy efficiency package to go into that. So lots of wall insulation, attic insulation, getting a decent heating system as part of this gut rehab.
Right, right. And you were already attuned to the value of that from your college days.
Exactly. I'd done some energy efficiency work in college. My master's thesis was on soft energy paths in urban areas and how you apply that to an urban area. I figured it was easy to do it in a rural area, but what about in a city with high rises, et cetera?
Right, right. Very difficult. And you might have heard of a guy named Amory Lovins back at that time, too. He was making waves, wasn't he?
He actually inspired me. He came and gave a talk at our school. And, I was listening. And the friend I went with said, that sounds great. How would it work in cities? I go, good question. There's my thesis.
He's a neighbor of mine. I still have our house out in Snowmass.
Yeah, I see him. I haven't seen him in about a year now, but I do see him periodically.
We see him all the time. It's a lot of fun. He's just exactly the same as he always was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As you knew. So you left this community-based group. That sounds like a really rewarding job. And went to Audubon, I want to say around Boston. Is that right?
Yeah, we were just outside of Boston.
And what was your work?
All of Massachusetts.
What was your job there?
It was to coordinate their energy efficiency activities with a particular focus on urban areas. So most of my work was in Greater Boston, but we did do some stuff in other parts of the state.
And when I was trying to remember, I was briefing for this discussion with you, and I I was trying to remember when I first met you, and I thought you were at Mass Save. But is yep. that I but you were in Massachusetts, but you were not at Mass Save, you were at Audubon at the time.
Right. So we did lots of work with the city of Boston and community-based groups. We also did a bunch of stuff with the legislature. For example, we helped author the appliance standards bill that helped lead to the national appliance standards bill that was in 86.
Right, right. And then you went to the New England Electric System.
Yes.
And I don't know, I was trying to think of who was there. I mean, Al Destrabaugh and Tom Foley, maybe. And
Big Al came after me.
After you. Okay. So what was your role there? I take it you're in the energy efficiency group.
Right. They were just starting to expand their energy efficiency programs, and they brought me in to help plan and evaluate these energy efficiency programs. So I helped develop their first new construction program. I helped evaluate some of their small CNI stuff and design things. I did stuff with water heaters and various other programs, but as they were going from pilots to full-scale programs.
Right, and must have been a really exciting time in Nice, or New England Electric became a real leader. PG&E in Southern California, Edison out here, and New England Electric there in Boston, Edison, some of the leading utilities. I imagine that your experience working within a utility has prepared you well to be working with all these utilities that you've been working with ever since.
Right, exactly. No, I understand where they're coming from, what they have to deal with. I could also share a few war stories so they could say, okay, he's one of us, not one of them.
Hey, I don't know if you realize this. I started my career at the New York Power Authority.
Oh, yeah.
And then I came out here and I was the director of energy efficiency for Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. And yeah. you really do gain, as I know you did, you really gain an appreciation for the depth of these organizations and the complexity and the skill sets that are all brought together to keep the lights on. It's kind of a phenomenal machine.
Right. And what motivates them and what buttons you have to push and what buttons to avoid, you know, as you are.
Especially which ones to avoid.
Right. You're ultimately trying to get the management to say this works for us. So what are the things that are going to motivate them? What are their concerns going to be and how can you address them?
So after New England Electric, why did you go to ACEEE? What was the draw there?
I wasn't looking to move, but I went to the ACEEE summer study and happened to meet the executive director at the time. And someone was trying to recruit me for another job. And he said, oh, if you're thinking of leaving, why don't you work for us? So I interviewed with him and I just like the idea of going national. I've been working just in Massachusetts and being able to work on a whole bunch of issues. You know, if you're dealing at the state level, you're dealing with one company or one government. And if they don't want to do something, well, what do? Well, if you're at the national level and you're working with Massachusetts and they don't want to do something, well, there's, you know, 49 other states. And at any given time, there's always something fun to do that can really make a difference, you know, that they are ready to embrace some change.
So Howard Geller really is to be thanked for shaping your career, right?
Yep.
Bringing you to ACEEE, getting you away from Boston, all those academics up there. And then
instead, I'm surrounded by Beltway bandits and all these government officials.
Take your pick, right? You mentioned the summer study, and I wasn't going to talk about that, but ACEEE put on, and I guess is still putting on every other summer, out at Pacific Grove at Asilomar, the Asilomar State Campground, I guess it's called there, or State Conference Facility. But it's just a fantastic conference. I went several times. People from all over the world would come for 4 or 5 or 6 days. And what incredible networking that took place. And it's still going strong?
Oh, it's still going strong. We had more than 1,000 people last year, just coming off of COVID. But yes, even before I joined ACEEE, it was always the one conference I really wanted to go to. I'd always save my best paper topics to submit, because my previous employers would generally send me as long as I had a paper accepted. So that was the trick.
Right. Yes. For many of us. So talk about ACEEE. I know it was founded before you got there, but what was its earliest mission? And then we'll talk sort of about how the mission is advanced today.
Right. So ACEEE helps advance energy efficiency programs, policies, technologies. Originally, it was primarily a research organization. We'd produce reports on various energy efficiency topics, but reports that would really have application in the real world and not just to sit on shelves. But over the years, we continue to do a lot of research reports, but there's been increasing emphasis on policy adoption, technical assistance, how do we help people to adopt and implement programs and policies, where the reports are a foundation, but that is just one of the things we do as opposed to the primary thing we do.
Right. So if you had to sort of look back or have a sort of look from above and think about what has ACEEE's greatest contribution been? I mean, for me, it was a lot of really good information, kind of easy access to information. Yeah. But how would you answer that question?
I would answer that question that our research, advocacy, and education really helped lead to some path-breaking changes. We were one of the first ones to talk about energy efficiency, demand side management, energy efficiency resource standards. We're now up to 26 states that have energy efficiency resource standards. We're spending roughly $8 billion a year on energy efficiency. I think we made significant contributions. Many other people did too. We do a lot of work with Congress. So most of the appliance standards we helped enact, whether it was the 1987 law that added the original appliances in 92, 2005, 2007, and beyond. You know, we're now more than 50 products, and just about all of them, our fingerprints are all over it. And then I would note, just to wrap that up, the Inflation Reduction Act, which people are doing, we were heavily involved with, including such things as the fact that some of the new construction, whether residential, commercial, tax incentives go up to net zero. That was stuff we worked on. The homes program, the residential retrofit, other people also worked on that, but we were the ones who say, let's double the incentive for those who are lower moderate income, you know, those types of things. Oh, the industrial provision, that was based on a proposal we had that's, you know, almost $6 billion for transformative new industrial processes. That was, you know, by and large, our idea.
That's great. That's great. And it's kind of a tough question, but do you think that solar has sort of stolen the spotlight from efficiency? I mean, I go back in the efficiency world a long time in the DSM days, and now solar is so sexy, I guess, is so visible. Have they sort of stolen the spotlight, or is there still adequate support and understanding of the core value of efficiency?
Both. And in fact, I'd say very recently, there's even greater support coming. But yes, we've shared a lot of the spotlight with solar and other renewables. But we like to say they're like peanut butter and jelly. It's hard to do one without the other. Yes, you can put on solar onto a home or a building, but it will be more expensive if it's an inefficient building. And then if you need a battery backup, it's a larger battery. What is this contribution going to be to peak demand, particularly as we start moving more toward winter peaks as people electrify? We need to really get those loads down, or else we're going to have to be building lots of power plants just to operate every 2 or 3 years when there's a polar vortex. So we see efficiency incredibly important to complement solar and other renewables, but also as a way to really get down the costs and demand as we electrify many end uses.
Yeah, well, thank you for all those amazing accomplishments, and I really like this discussion of the peanut butter and jelly. And I would say the efficiency has got to precede the solar. And you know, I'm largely in the solar business out here in California, and there's a lot of solar companies that are running around selling their wares, not talking about efficiency. And as consultants, we're always trying to make sure that voting order is clearer, because there is this excitement about solar and there's less excitement about relighting and fantastic stuff that's going on right now with efficiency, with LEDs and heat pumps and controls. And I mean, the real continues to go kind of crazy in a good way, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, there's a lot of need. You do efficiency. Your house is going to be comfortable even when the power goes out. You're in California with all those, what do they call them when they shut the power off because there's imminent fear of, a fire or something.
Well, they call those PSPS events, public safety power shutoff, which means that you're in a world of hurt because it could go on for a whole week. And the utilities are saying, well, there's high winds. And so you're on your own. So good point that the more efficient a home is, the tighter it is, the more it will maintain its thermal for the thermal temperature. Let's talk decarbonization. It's got to be a huge part of what you're up to now.
Absolutely.
I mean, all these buildings want to decarbonize. And so all of a sudden we're getting rid of natural gas or heating oils and we're bringing in heat pumps and we're jacking up the loads dramatically, right?
Yes and no. Yes, we're bringing those in. Those are a form of energy efficiency because a heat pump is, quite a bit more efficient than even a condensing gas furnace. But yes, we do need to do the efficiency to keep those loads down. You're going to need a lot more power to use a heat pump on an inefficient home than if you make it more efficient. And it's going to be more comfortable, too, because how you feel in a home doesn't depend just on the air temperature, but also the temperature of the surfaces around you and the airflow. And so doing efficiency can make you more comfortable with the heat pump, particularly since the heat pump distribution air temperature is much lower. So you want to do other things to help improve comfort. So we see it as an efficiency as well as electrification as well as renewable as all three critical ingredients of decarbonization.
And then you mentioned early off your works with weatherizing homes in and around New Haven and in Connecticut. And so and you can see for new construction, you can see how a heat pump comes in and is already a super efficient device. I guess, Steve, I'm concerned about how do you go into the retrofit market, and not just residential, but especially the larger commercial buildings. How do we electrify those? And does efficiency become a really big piece of that equation?
Yes, there are different approaches for different buildings. Yes, if you have a central heating system and you have central air conditioner, it's pretty easy to put in a heat pump the next time the central air needs to be replaced. But let's say you have a hot water boiler. In Europe, there's heat pumps, air-to-water heat pumps that will heat the water that can just be distributed via the hot water radiators, not via the steam radiators. But the average American home, the radiators are designed for 160-degree water. Those heat pumps will produce 140-degree water. So you need to weatherize the home to cut the heat loss down so you get enough heat with 140-degree water circulating through those radiators and not 160. Right. And then in commercial buildings, whether it's rooftop heat pump systems, variable refrigerant flow systems, which are effectively large mini splits, or there are chiller size systems that are heat pumps that you can install, and there's different reasons to do different systems in different buildings, but they all are going to play a role.
You sound very optimistic.
I am. I'm an eternal optimist.
I am too. I share that with you. You are. Now, how about electric mobility? Because when I think of the building sector right now that you're so involved with, I think that you're adding, we're decarbonizing, we're trying to get rid of all of our fossil fuels. So we're basically adding to the grid, even though we're doing it efficiently, we're adding to the load to the grid. And then you got people like me driving electric vehicles, and then you're adding that load as well. Is ACEEE involved with that?
Yeah, we are quite heavily involved in electric vehicles, some on the passenger vehicles. We primarily focus on how do you bring these vehicles to more disadvantaged areas? Because so many other people are working on how do you bring it to, Marin County or something like that. Right. But we also are doing a lot of work on more medium and heavy duty vehicles, which are more of a challenge. But we now have several manufacturers that are producing electric 18 wheelers. And we've been working on that. One of the things we contributed to in the Inflation Reduction Act is the first ever incentive, federal tax incentive for medium and heavy duty electric and fuel cell vehicles. So I've heard through the grapevine, I haven't talked to him, but I heard when Elon Musk heard about that, he says, okay, we really have to make this Tesla Semi a product we can sell as opposed to something we just tout and it's always a year or two away.
Right. It was like 4 or 5 years from the time that they introduced it to now when they're really rolling them out, I guess. Now, Frito-Lay has a bunch of trucks.
But let me just follow up with that for a second. But we get involved in some of the trickier issues. If for cars, the cars are distributed enough that most of them will get charged overnight, that there will be gradual increases in load, but it's not going to be a sudden increase by and large. But with the trucks, where you have a fleet and all of a sudden you need to charge, 10 18-wheelers or 50 18-wheelers, we are talking tens of megawatts per. And we're encouraging utilities to pay attention to distribution planning, to understand where the fleets are, where the truck stops are, and where they really are going to need 10, 20, 40 megawatts of load at a particular point. As a rough rule of thumb, if you have 20 megawatts or more, you need a new substation. So this is not just, run an extension cord. This is major distribution work.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I guess a household charger, like my household charger, is 7 kW, whereas we're working with a school district and we have an electric fleet down near San Diego, and the chargers are 100 kW. So you start simultaneously powering those babies up. And like you're saying, you got significant load. I wanted to go
back. The 18-wheelers are 1 to 2 megawatts a pop.
Ouch. That's it. There you go. Let's talk just for a moment about the disadvantaged areas. I just heard this term recently. It's probably old hat to you, like this notion of a charging desert, kind of like a food desert where there's no supermarkets, the charging desert where there's no chargers. But what are the ways that, and that's in part because in a lot of lower income neighborhoods, people don't have their own garage, their own parking spot. They're using public parking or they're using a garage with common spaces. But what are some of the ways that you see accelerating the adoption of EVs with lower income customers?
Right. I mean, a couple of things. One, we have some of these federal dollars for charging, state dollars in some places. We need to make sure they serve all neighborhoods, and particularly neighborhoods that are, as you say, charging deserts. Likewise, utilities are investing in chargers, and they should invest in these neighborhoods. I say particularly multifamily is a good thing for them to concentrate on, because there is a building, maybe a parking lot or garage with 50, 100 spaces, and make sure that some of them have chargers. We see Uber and Lyft drivers as a critical early market. These people, by and large, are not super wealthy. It's a working wage, but they tend to live in lower rent areas, and you need chargers for them if, people like Uber and Lyft are pledging, oh, yeah, we're going to electrify. But you have to make sure it works for your current drivers.
Makes total sense. What other, are there other project areas that are big in your life that I have omitted from this conversation?
Yes, let me talk about industry for a second, where we like the tough things. Homes are relatively easy, and yes, we do some stuff at homes, but 18-wheelers or industry is another area that we've been concentrating in more lately. Half of industry's process heat needs are at 160 degrees centigrade or below. There are industrial heat pumps that can get up that high. Can we displace half of the boilers in industry with electric heat pumps? And some of it is getting the heat pump to provide the hot water or steam. 160 obviously is steam, not water. But also, if you design carefully for the actual system instead of a big steam loop or something, you can save another 20-30% by focusing on things. So how can we really get that process heat load, which is the biggest load in most factories, down. Likewise, we're looking at new process technologies to tackle some of the toughest industries. There's direct reduction iron using hydrogen as a very low carbon way to make steel. There is inert anode aluminum to dramatically reduce emissions from aluminum production. There are new cements, both the combination materials as well as either, hydrogen or electric heaters to produce a cement with dramatically lower carbon emissions. But we have to systematically go through each of the industries, say, what are the big emissions? What are the opportunities? And we've been trying to do that, working with people in industry, working with people in Congress and DOE, to help start making that. And you have a lot of industries now that are pledging to decarbonize by 2050, but a pledge is easy. That's the hard work, is how do we get that to happen? And that means that careful work of industrial heat pumps and, inert anode aluminum, et cetera, et cetera, times hundreds of different processes.
And Steve, thanks for all you're doing. It's amazing. It's amazing to hear about your, you've been inducted to the Energy Efficiency Hall of Fame. you had a 40-year career, over 200 publications, lots of testimony and congressional testimony and state testimony. Wow, what a great run! Not that it's over, but what a great run. How do you keep balance? How do you keep your enthusiasm and the optimism that you mentioned?
We have great staff. So some of it is I love working with the staff and helping people who are younger than me get started in the field and really prosper and grow. I love seeing successes, things like, the Inflation Reduction Act this last year was a real supercharge. That doesn't happen every year, but it's really nice. And hopefully that gives me several more years of charge to go. Now we're implementing that and, to watch the states and industrial companies, et cetera, be excited about how they can contribute to implementing that. That's really helps. But then I believe in working hard, but also taking some time off. As you may know, a few years ago, I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail over 4 years, just unplugged. In the High Sierras, there was only one place to get cell phone service the entire 2 weeks. Happened to be the top of Mount Whitney, where no one was blocking me.
Oh, wow. Wow, how great. Good for you. Well, Steve, carry on. It's been great catching up with you. And thanks so much for all that you're doing and that you will be doing, and to the staff at ACAAA and all the people that makes that organization fly. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Certainly. It's been a great run, but working with people like you. So thank you.
Bye, Steve.
Okay, bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.